Chair.
Did we skip a day?
I think we did. Mr. Chair, where were you? We were all sitting in this room all day waiting for you.
Doesn't seem like I missed a day of work. I don't know exactly where I was.
So if I can, Mr. Chair, what we want to do, Senator Skoy and I were just talking, is the House has posted the agenda of what it wants to work on today. I think yesterday morning, I can't remember. So we want to work through those. It's five different cities, economic development projects. And then we wanted to get to tobacco as well. Mm-hmm. And then we thought we would do some cleanup of, or some items that were missed yesterday, mm-hmm. that the Senate had on a list, TIF and whatever you want to do,
yep.
Mr. Chair. And Senator Skoy, do you want to clean up a couple little items while we wait for folks who were trying to get here?
We could clean up a couple little items while we're waiting. Okay. I think it's a good idea to move forward on the five projects that we both have provisions dealing with. Okay. And I think tobacco is in both bills, so we should go through that. And then we did have some provisions that we wanted to talk about yesterday, mm-hmm. that I think would be good if we got to. TIF would be the one I'd like to probably start with to,
okay.
clear the deck on that. We could just finish that up maybe.
Okay, so and timing-wise, when are you on the floor today?
11, but we have Transportation and Senate Tax Committee at 10, and I'm going to have that committee hearing this year.
So we're going to have to stop recess at 10, right?
Yes.
Okay, and then
maybe we can come back after that.
It'd be nice to work during something today. The House tends to have these extended caucuses that I think we could all skip.
Let me talk to leadership. Maybe the Senate could actually work through floor session today. I think we're all pretty familiar with what we're going to be debating.
In the House, that doesn't change anything. The fact that people are familiar. What time did we finish last night? 11. I don't know. It never speeds anything up to know what you're doing in the House.
Let's see. Let's see how it all goes. But I am with you. I'd like to keep meeting through the
okay.
day today.
Okay, so I think if that's okay with all the conferees, the goal would be to try to get through all these things. And, yes, we'll be here this morning and we'll be here at night, but if we could meet in the middle of the day sometime too, that would be great. And we'll just keep posting that as we communicate between the House and Senate, because we understand you're taking up the transportation bill in your committee. So
yeah, I have to get the transportation bill to the floor today. And so I don't think it's going to take a long time, but it will take some
okay.
time.
Okay, sounds good. So, Ms. Dalton, can we do the multiple points of use then maybe while we're waiting for a few people who aren't yet here? And this, Senator Skoy and other conferees who were here will remember, we thought we could move yesterday, but we didn't quite have the language, and there was supposed to be agreement between the House and Senate, and we have the language now. So Ms. Pollock looks like she's got it. And thank you. And I don't know if it's Ms. Dalton or Ms. Pollock or Ms. Von Mosch or who wants to tell us what we're doing. This bill was carried by Representative Davids in the House. And I'm not sure, was it Senator Rest who did it in the Senate?
I think it was, yes.
Okay. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, the language you have in front of you is agreed-upon language worked out with the interested parties, with the Department of Revenue, and with House and Senate nonpartisan staff. The House bill originally had just gone back to old law, which required the use of a multiple points of use certificate, and it was not an option for any of these digital goods and software that was going to be used in multiple locations. The Senate language was essentially what had been proposed by the industry, which allowed these things to be optional, allowed them sole discretion on how they allocated the sales tax, and provided some 90-day language regarding when the certificate had to be submitted to the seller. This compromise basically does the following things. It makes the multiple points of use exemption certificate optional, so they can use it sometimes, but if it's less convenient to use it, they don't have to. They must, therefore, it's not allowed to be just file it once with a distributor and then it continues onward indefinitely, you have to file it each time you make a purchase so that they know that that's what you want to do on this purchase. It removes the sole discretion of the how to allocate the tax from the purchaser. It requires that it be done on a reasonable but consistent and uniform method, which was the old language. And it removes the 90-day delayed provision. It requires that it be filed at the time of purchase. But it does reference that the seller is exempt from liability from taking one of these things as long as they have it within 90 days, which is the same provision for exemption certificates, other exemption certificates under current law.
I want to hear from Ms. Pollack.
Sure.
Okay. Ms. Pollack, please.
Madam Chair, I would have nothing more to add. The department has also waited on this, and I think we all agree that this is workable language.
Okay, thank you. Senator Sklar.
Thank you. And Ms. Pollack or Ms. Dalton, the consistent and uniform method, is who's the arbitrator of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoey, this would be something that they would do, and it would be something that the department could challenge on audit if they felt that it was not reasonable and consistent. However, under the original language that had been proposed by the industry, only the purchaser got to decide what was reasonable and consistent. This allows the department to weigh in on what's reasonable and consistent.
Thank you.
Okay. You're comfortable with that? Okay. I'll go ahead and move that then. We talked about it yesterday. Discussion. Oh, Senator Scoey moves the multiple points of use agreed upon legislation as proposed.
Madam
Discussion.
Chair.
What was that?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Ms. Templin.
I just wanted to bring to your attention on page 5 of this spreadsheet that this provision does have a revenue impact in the range of $1.3 million. In the fiscal 14-15 biennium. Both the Senate and the House have this provision. The revenue impact is different because of the different rates. For the House at the 6.875 rate, the revenue impact is $1.37 million for the fiscal 14-15 biennium.
Senator Scoey withdraws his motion.
I withdraw the motion.
Yeah, I think we'll think on that a little bit. Thank you, Ms. Templin, for catching that.
You know, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Scoey.
I do have a provision that's on our same and similars list that we probably should have adopted the first night but didn't, but I'm willing to think we should move now
sure.
Just to kind of keep current. It's that Board of Water Soil Resources
sure.
Housekeeping thing.
Okay.
Article.
Which language are you moving there?
I'm moving the House language, Article 4, Sections 1 through 5.
Does everyone have that? This was one that was the same.
Madam Chair, was it
Senator Stenjum.
Article 4, what?
Article, Section, Senator Scoey?
Sections 1 through 5.
Sections 1 through 5. House,
yeah.
Article 4. Does everyone have that? Discussion?
Yep.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The Scoey motion's adopted. Senator Scoey, I had a chance to wander over and talk to your staff before you came in the room. And if we can, we've got four chairs up there now. We'd like to ask Mr. Michael and Ms. Dalton. And we think it's Ms. Pollack and Mr. Sylvia to join us at the table. And I think the way that we can think about these collectively, because I know that the Senate is putting some of these together as it relates to the sales tax construction exemption, if they can all join us at the table, I know we haven't, and I think it's been good, we haven't been doing this detailed side by side. But in this instance, I think it'll just save time since we have an hour so far this morning to hear about the five cities. So if the Senate and House research want to tell us the differences in the bill. So for the public, we've got, you know, five big projects here, the Baxter proposal for Brooklyn Park and the Emerson proposal in Shakopee. We've got the South Loop development in Bloomington. We've got the DMC in Rochester and 3M in Maplewood. So that's kind of what we want to talk about right now. And the House and Senate, I think, are committed to getting moving on these projects. So that's the good news. We just are looking at them in some cases a little bit differently and some the exact same. So if we can just walk through them, and then we can talk about them. Senator Scoey.
In Bloomington, are you contemplating separating the South Loop from, because of the transit station, from the other provision in Bloomington, or are those contemplated as a package?
There's no transit station in Bloomington.
Mall of America.
I mean, the transit station is aren't being
already there.
They're not. Oh, Bloomington Central Station.
Yes.
As part of South Loop, the McGough development. We've got a TIF provision on that. I carried it as a bill together, and then the public amenity part is the old Cedar Avenue Bridge. So it's a three big development projects within a project. So I think you may have it on your list of TIF, Bloomington Central Station. So I think they might be identical, but I don't know that.
But not including the Mall of America expansion.
I mean, I carried it as a bill together, and so I don't know if you guys broke them into different pieces, or I guess we'll have to have them tell us about that. So I didn't track that. So would Miss Pollock or Mr. Michael or someone want to tell us what page of the side by side we should start looking at these projects on? And
Madam Chair, I think that the order that we've concluded that it makes most sense to go through these in is to start with the ones where the House and the Senate are very similar, which is the Baxter, Emerson, Maplewood provisions. So I think we'll start with and it's on page 58, which is the Emerson facility, and that's going to be Ms. Dalton and Ms. Pollock, since those are sales tax.
Ms. Dalton and Ms. Pollock, page 58, is that right? Did you say?
Section
no.
13.
Section 13.
That's not page
58. 58 of the side by side. It's at the very bottom.
At the bottom section.
It's the third of section 13.
Okay, yes. Before you start there, if we can, conferees, it would be great if we could. I know we'll want to ask a lot of questions about each of these, but it would be great if we could get through all five of them from these four people and then talk about all of them, because that way we don't have to do that briefing again later today.
We could just write our questions down.
Yes. Yes. Okay, perfect. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, these first two are actually should not engender very many questions at all because they are identical in both bills. Section 13 is the Industrial Measurement, Manufacturing, and Controls Facility. It requires a $60 million capital investment and employment.
Ms. Dalton, we can't really hear you.
Oh.
Might have to put that mic right on top
Sorry.
Of
it. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can just give her this one.
The Emerson provision is a capital equipment, a construction exemption, a sales tax exemption for construction. It requires a total capital investment of $60 million, employment of 250 new FTEs, and requires the Department of Employment and Economic Security to make sure that all the requirements are met. The tax is paid at the time of purchase and is then refunded. And is effective for June 30th, 2013. As I said, they are identical in both bills, and I will let Ms. Pollock do the other one.
Ms. Pollock, please.
Madam Chair and members, the next provision that's identical is on page 59 of the side-by-side. It's House Article 8, Section 15, Senate Article 7, Section 41. And this is the biopharmaceutical manufacturing facility. This is a sales tax exemption for material supplies, capital equipment, for construction, an expansion and improvement of a biopharmaceutical manufacturing facility. The capital investment has to be at least $50 million. The facility must create and maintain at least 150 full-time employee positions, and that must be certified by deed every year that the sales tax refund is requested. And the exemption also applies to materials used in privately owned infrastructure that is used to support the facility. That tax is paid at the time of purchase and then refunded. The way that the refund works for the general capital equipment exemption for this provision is that it's paid out at 25% of the amount annually, so it's kind of a staggered refund provision. And if you look at the effective dates, it's retroactive to investments made in jobs created after December 31, 2012 and before July 1, 2019. So it's possible that the refunds, as they're metered out, could be paid after July 2019.
Okay. Thank you. And those are the same, right?
Madam Chair, yes, they're the same.
Okay. Where should we go next?
Madam Chair, I think next we'll turn to the Maplewood 3M R&D facility, and maybe the way we should start with that is to stay with Ms. Pascala and talk about the sales tax provision, which the House does not have, but the Senate does have, since that's what we're on.
Okay, great. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, this is on the top of page 60, Senate Article 7, Section 42. This is, again, a construction materials and supplies and equipment exemption for those supplies and materials for a qualifying research and development facility, which has lab space of at least 400,000 square feet and uses high and low intensity labs, and it has to have a total construction investment cost of at least $140 million in a two-year period. It's effective for sales and purchases made after June 30 of this year and before September 1 of 2015.
Okay. So the rest of 3M?
Right. And as I indicated, the House does not have a similar sales tax exemption for that project. All the House has is the tax increment provision, which is on page 70 of the side-by-side. That's section 16. And what this authorizes the city to do is to establish a redevelopment tax increment district for this project without meeting the blight test. So that's a 25-year district. And the other deviations from general law that are provided is that there's an exception from the pooling rules for this district, so long as all of the expenditures are made within the project area. So this will permit the city to use the increments from the site for infrastructure on the 3M campus. The third exception from general law is that the five-year rule has extended to 10 years, so the city would have 10 years to complete these infrastructure improvements. And there is another deviation, but in the opposite direction, in that it's more restrictive than general law with a knockdown rule. Normally, the knockdown rule, as you may remember from the exception that you adopted before from general law for some projects, is a four-year rule. So if there's no development on a parcel within 4 years, that gets dropped out of the tax increment district. This provision, in fact, shortens that 4 years to 1 year. So if the development doesn't happen within 1 year after the city certifies the district, the parcel would be dropped from the district. So those are the special pooling rules for this, or the special tax increment rules for this project.
Thank you. That cover everything for 3M, from both bills?
Madam Chair, just to indicate that the Senate has the same and identical tax increment financing provision in our bill.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. Next. Those were relatively easier.
Yes.
I still can't even believe we're doing all these, but that's a different issue.
Madam Chair, I think we'll now get into the more the provisions that the two bills are a little different on, by moving to the Bloomington Mall of America South Loop Old Cedar Avenue Bridge provisions in the House bill. And these are all in, they start on page 65 of the
oh yeah 67
that government use involved that's on 67
it's
section 1 page 63
the very first section of the economic development article, which
is this page 63
okay. Section 1 on the bottom, and this provides an exception or an expansion of Bloomington's special law that provides a competitive bidding exemption that applies to projects that involve both public improvements and private improvements. These exemptions are common. Minneapolis has them as well for these kind of for these projects, where typically what's involved is a publicly owned parking ramp that's attached to a private private building of some sort. Public bidding laws would normally require that the publicly owned parking ramp be publicly bid, but because of the challenges that the private companies have with building, they don't want to be having a separate contractor for these two buildings that are attached. It's very common practice to essentially grant a competitive bidding exemption for these types of projects. What this does is to expand that exemption so that it applies to improvements, other public improvements besides public parking ramps, and that it needs to be, it can be adjacent to and not necessarily attached. So it's a slight expansion of this competitive bidding exemption that Bloomington has had since the mall was constructed back in the mid-'80s. And the Senate does not have a comparable provision. The next provision is on page 67 at the top, section 7. This is the fiscal disparities computation, and this is linked to a later tax increment provision, and I'll describe them together. And essentially what this does is to say that for the two Mall of America districts in Bloomington, that starting with taxes payable in 2014, that instead of the fiscal disparities taxes that those two districts are paying, instead of that being contributed to the pool, to the fiscal disparities pool, instead those taxes on the captured value would be captured as tax increment and would then be available to Bloomington to be used as tax increment. Now these two districts, and now we're moving on to the actual tax increment provision, which is on page 68, the next page at the bottom, section 11. What this provides is that those districts would essentially be bifurcated so that they would be decertified for regular tax purposes as they are currently scheduled to be decertified. So if I'm remembering this right, 2016 and 2019, they would go back on the tax rolls for purposes of the city, the school, and the county for the regular purposes, but would be extended to capture these fiscal disparities taxes through potentially 2034. And that if the city if the developer does not construct at least $100 million of additional improvements by 2021, then they would be decertified in 2023. So essentially what would happen is that these districts, the regular tax increment districts, would be decertified as they're scheduled, but for an additional, varying for 15 years or 17 years, they would still be capturing the fiscal disparities contribution taxes to be available to pay for the development. And the one additional wrinkle on this is that the first year of the fiscal disparities taxes, which is estimated to be about $9 million, would be required to be used by Bloomington to pay for the cost of essentially replacing and restoring the old Cedar Avenue Bridge, which is down on the very bottom of this South Loop project area that these districts are in. So essentially that's the thumbnail explanation of how this works. So what So basically, the fiscal disparities taxes would go on to provide additional revenue beyond the normal period, but the regular tax increment district would go back on the tax rolls. The Senate has a different structure, which I'll let Eric describe.
Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair, back on page 67, Article 2, Section 35, the Senate has a provision dealing with fiscal disparities that's different from the House, and what this provision does was provide an additional $4 million to the City of Bloomington from the fiscal disparities area-wide pool for 10 years from taxes payable in 2014 to taxes payable 2023, and it just directs that the Hennepin County Auditor distribute the additional $4 million from the pool to the City of Bloomington.
And then,
could I interrupt for just a
sure,
minute?
Sure, Chair's going.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the Senate sent some language over to Mr. Michaels yesterday. And did you get the chance to see that, Mr. Michaels? Did you get a chance to review that language that we sent over with regard to this?
I'm not aware of any. I apologize. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Senator Descoy, I don't think I got any.
We'll get copies of that.
Okay.
I just haven't seen that language yet.
Okay. Sounds good. And I think there's still. Yeah, and I think you want it. Is the sales tax construction exemption in the 10%?
I think we'll get the language and talk about that. But yes, we're.
It's not in here now, physically. I mean, is there more for Ms. Pollack to tell us about the Bloomington development?
Madam Chair, there is a sales tax exemption for construction materials for this project.
So you want to still continue on that?
Sure.
Okay. Yes, please. Thank you. Where should we go for that? 17. Is that?
Madam Chair, page 60 of the side-by-side, section 44.
Page 60. Yes, please.
Madam Chair, this is a sales tax exemption for materials and supplies and equipment incorporated into construction or improvement of the projects that would be in this Bloomington Mall of America TIF district project. And there's a minimum investment of at least $250 million. And the exemption is effective for purchases after June 30 of this year and before July 1, 2024.
Okay. Section 44, yes. Okay, so does that cover the South Loop development in Bloomington in totality in both bills? No? Mr.
Madam
Michael?
Chair, we did not go over the changes for the separate Bloomington Central Station tax increment district, which is a separate tax increment district from the Mall of America districts, as you're well aware, in the City of Bloomington. That's to the east of the Mall of America districts. And that those provisions appear on page 67 of the bill and on the side-by-side, excuse me. And there are three changes that are specific to that. This district had previously received special legislation in 2008 that extended its five-year rule to 10 years. The bill extends that 10 years to 15 years, and it also allows the city to extend the duration of this district by 8 years. And the third thing that it does is it unfreezes the certified original tax capacity rate so that the full combined tax rate would generate increment.
Okay, and you know, I just thought of one other piece is labor piece. Where is that in the House bill?
Yes,
yes. Oh, was that added? That wasn't added? Oh, right. Where we added it on the House floor. And you don't have it. And so
that's not.
We added it. Did we add it to the tax bill?
Madam
yes.
Chair.
Okay, so
it is in
that's,
the
that's
it
what
is.
I'd like to be. Okay, so that'll be part of the Rochester discussion.
Madam Chair, that provision is in the House tax bill, but it's not specific to any of these projects. It's a general law change that applies to developments across the state in first-class cities.
Okay. Okay, so we may be, because of the time element.
And counties.
So we, I think we should go to Rochester then and get through the DMC differences, and then we'll be able, because I was telling Chair Skoy, I did ask MMB to talk to us also about the Rochester proposal today, and I'd like to get that in this morning so folks can think about that before we come back again. So if we can go through the Rochester provisions.
Madam Chair.
From the four of you. Senator Senjum.
Will we be, I just had a question going back to the Emerson one. I don't know if now or later is a good time.
I think a quick question's okay. I just really want to make sure we get through all of them before we have to recess. And what's left is your city, right. Senator Senjum.
Well, I so Senator Senjum. I just don't. Well,
yes, yes, on Emerson.
Well, going back to top of page 59, my question was, effective for sales and purchases after June 30th, is that forever and ever, or like most of these, is there a time frame or a deadline? In other words, 50 years from now, does Emerson still get a sales tax exemption?
I think it's drafted forever. Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is no sunset date on this one.
Okay, that's a good point, so we can think about that. Thank you, Senator Senjum. Section 14, is that right, Senator Senjum?
Section 13, yes, Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, we apologize, there's an error on the side-by-side, the Senate provision is otherwise identical except the exemption sunsets December 31, 2015.
Okay. So we'll want to remember that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And since we're on little questions here before Rochester, Section 44 of page 60 of the side-by-side on the retail, hotel, amusement, office, construction project, Senate language for the Bloomington South Loop, is that the two-mile radius? So that's for both the Bloomington Central Station and the Mall of America, or how are you viewing that provision?
Not the South Loop.
Just for the mall.
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to understand it. Okay, thank you. So can we go to Rochester? And I don't know who wants to start. Lots of sections, I think. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll just start with Section 1, which is identical in both bills.
What page? I'm
it
sorry.
It is on page 73.
73. Thank you.
And the first section is a construction materials exemption for sales tax exemption for the public infrastructure associated with the DMC. Its effective date is for purchases made after June 30th, 2015.
Okay. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, Section 2 provides definitions for both the House and Senate bill. Here's where the bills will start to differ. The House has a definition of the Destination Medical Center Corporation. The Senate does not use that entity as part of its structure of the DMC. I don't know if you are there any other definitions, Ms. Dalton, that are worth noting for purposes of differences?
Ms. Dalton. Mr.
Madam
Michael.
Chair, the other, I think the other key difference in the definitions is that the Senate bill has a more expansive definition of the public infrastructure projects, which that definition is important because it determines what you can use the state aid money for. The House bill definitions are limited to what I think most people would think of as classic public infrastructure, and that they're all things that are owned by the public, whereas the Senate also allows the state aid to be used to assist with privately owned development. So that would allow it for assisting, for example, a hotel or a park, you know, parking ramp that's owned privately or something of that nature. But otherwise, they're pretty much similar, except where it's necessary to, because of the different structures in the two bills. Section 3, as Ms. Pollack indicated, is where we begin to deviate in the governance structure that's proposed. The House bill essentially uses a governance structure that has the operational decisions being made directly by the city. But what it does is to direct the city to establish a nonprofit corporation that has a defined, specified board of directors that will do the planning functions for the DMC. And this, the governing body for this nonprofit corporation, has they have 9 members, and the membership of this is the mayor or the mayor's designee, a member of the city council, a member of the county board, 2 representatives of the Mayo Clinic that will be selected by the city from 5 nominees that are provided by the clinic to the city, 1 representative of labor selected by the city from 3 nominees provided by the local labor council, and then 1 representative of the city business community also selected by the city from among 3 nominees provided by the Chamber of Commerce, and then 2 appointees of the governor. This corporation would be subject to the open meeting law and the Government Data Practices Act. Now, there's a provision that's not in the House bill on data practices that the Civil Law Committee has approved, and so if you're going with the House system on this, you would want to adopt that amendment that essentially treats this corporation the same way universities are treated under the Data Practices Act, which allows them to shield the identity of some of their donors from public scrutiny. So that's one thing that's not in the House bill that you would want to add if you're going to adopt this. There are conflict of interest rules that are provided, and then the corporation is empowered to accept gifts and private money, and is allowed to actually, the corporation under the House's structure is a planning entity that would develop the plan for the DMC that would then be adopted by the city and implemented by the city. The one exception to where this nonprofit corporation could actually become an implementer or an active developer is if they get private money. That's just private money, not government money, not state aid, not city money, that they could then use that money to directly implement the development plan. But otherwise, under the House structure, the implementation of the plan is done by the city. So the city is the one that issues the bonds and goes forward with the projects.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, under the Senate plan, the Destination Medical Authority, or just refer to it as the authority going forward, is the entity that actually develops and implements the development plan. Financing is done by the authority, but we'll get to that in a later section. The authority board has 8 members. 4 are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. 2 are appointed by the city. 1 is appointed by the county, and 1 is appointed by Mayo. There are a number of restrictions on the governor's appointees. They may not be residents of the city. They may not have financial interests in Mayo or other Mayo projects under consideration. The authority is subject to the open meetings and data practices provisions. Other than that, I don't think I'd have anything to add about the governance structure.
Okay, so next pieces? No.
Madam Chair, Section 4 of the House bill is the section that specifies the requirements for the development plan, which, again, under the House bill is to be the work on this is to be done by this nonprofit corporation that the city is directed to charter, as we described before. So the nonprofit corporation would be the one that hires that essentially hires the staff and contracts, if it decides to do that, with consultants to prepare the development plan, and then the city actually would be required, after they've gone through that planning process, to approve and then implement implement the plan in this. These provision has the sort of the standard requirements that there'd be the consultant contracts, if they when they enter into those, would be subject to audit with regard to the use of the public money and so forth. The other thing is that subdivision 6 of this requires this corporation to annually report to the city and the state, and in the state the report goes to both the executive branch and to the legislature on the nature of the development plan, modifications to it, and the progress that the city is making in implementing that development plan, so that there's accountability as to the use of the state aid money that the state's providing to the city to implement this.
Madam Chair, the Senate provisions have somewhat similar requirements for reporting and audit of the authority. As you'll see on page 75 of the side-by-side, sections 4 and 5, the authority's financial statements are to be prepared in the same way as the city's financial statements. The authority must employ an accounting professional for annual exam and audit. The authority also has to send its budget to the House and Senate tax and tax committee chairs and minority members. The city or county may appropriate money for the authority's use, but again, it's the authority that is developing and making all of the implementation of the development plan. Unlike the House proposal, the city is not does not have the authority to approve or disapprove the development plan, but it may review it for consistency with the city's comprehensive plan and provide a written statement of support or opposition to any plan that the authority may develop. The authority is also required to hire a consultant to work on the development plan. The House authorizes the hiring of that consultant. And then there are also some minimum requirements for construction projects, and there are allowed a number of forms of contract for the design and build process. Continuing down on page 76, the powers and the duties of the authority. This is essentially what gives the authority the power to develop and construct the projects in the medical development district. Do you want to continue on?
Sure.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, moving on to Section 5 of the House bill, this provision...
Page 77.
On page 77 of the side-by-side. Section 5 grants additional powers to the city in order to implement the Destination Medical Center plan. I will say that essentially what the Senate bill does with its new authority is that this new authority is very closely patterned under the Port Authority law, and so most of the provisions that Ms. Pollack was describing essentially grant this new special purpose unit of government the powers of a port authority. What the House does instead is to simply say that the city, in implementing this plan, may exercise any of the powers that a port authority has. So to the extent that the city doesn't already have those powers under its normal city charter and state law, it could exercise port authority powers. And the main advantage of that is that it gives them some more flexibility in assisting private development that a city might not otherwise have. The second thing that this section does is it authorizes the city to provide money to the nonprofit corporation in order to carry out the planning functions. That nonprofit corporation really doesn't have any other source of revenue other than monies that the city gives to it or that it can get from private donations. The final thing that this does is it authorizes the city to issue bonds without holding a referendum on them and provides that those bonds are outside of the net debt limits. And I think the thinking behind that was that these bonds are largely going to be backed either by state, by a combination of state aid, which will be most of it, and by these various special taxes that Ms. Dalton will get into describing. That even though they're general obligations, the normal thought is that they would largely be paid by these other sources that don't affect property taxes, and so therefore it's appropriate to not have, not to require a referendum or to subject them to debt limits. The Senate, of course, does not have any of these provisions because it's investing these powers in this special purpose unit of government.
Ms. Dalton.
Chair, members of the committee, Section 6 is actually the city taxing authority. This is how the city can raise the $128 million that's it's required to raise as a its share of the DMC project. It allows a number of – none of these are required. These are all just options that the city may evaluate and pick and choose from. It may impose an additional lodging, local lodging tax, food and beverage tax, an admission or entertainment tax. If those taxes are imposed, they must be used to fund the projects. It also has the option to extend its existing local sales tax authority until 2041. And then use the additional revenues raised to fund this, or it may increase its general local sales tax, which is currently at 0.5 cent, by up to an additional 0.5 cent and use that revenue. It also has been granted some special abatement rules and special tax increment financing rules, which I will let Mr. Michael talk about.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the special abatement rules, that, as I understand it, the city already has done an abatement in this area in downtown. And there is a prohibition in the general law on abatements that says once you've done an abatement and you stop doing it, there's an eight-year sort of moratorium on abatements that you have to follow. What this does is to say that that eight-year moratorium doesn't apply. So the city or the city and the county, this authority also applies to the county, could decide as a way to raise, way to raise revenue for this that they could extend that abatement. And secondly, that the overall caps on the abatement that apply under general law would not apply to the city for this purpose. So that's just intended to give the city more options to raise revenue to meet this local match that we'll describe in the under the state aid provisions. The second provision is that they're given special tax increment financing rules, and that basically would allow them in the area of the that's designated as the DMC development area that they could establish redevelopment tax increment districts without meeting the blight test. That's sort of similar to what we talked about under the Maplewood provision. So they could create a 25-year district down in that downtown area, basically.
Mr. Sylvia.
If I could just add one other thing. Although we're granting the city the authority for some special rules dealing with tax increment financing, the authority itself does not have powers to establish tax increment financing districts. So I just wanted to clear that.
Great. Ms. Dalton or Ms. Pollack? What's next? Ms. Pollack, please.
Madam Chair, just a couple of differences in the city taxing authority. The Senate version authorizes only the admissions and entertainment tax. Ms. Dalton mentioned a number of options, a local lodging and food and beverage tax. The Senate provision only authorizes the city to implement an admissions and entertainment tax if it chooses. And the Senate provision allows an increase of 0.25% for the general sales tax authority. It's not listed on the side-by-side, but in the language, the option to extend the local sales tax is also authorized.
Ms. Dalton.
Section 7.
Page.
On page 78. Is the authority for the county to raise its share of the money that must go into the DMC. There's $119 million of the House bill refers to it as transit costs. The department, the Senate refers to it as transportation costs. They are essentially the same projects. essentially what the House does, it requires the counties to pay an amount equal to roughly a third of that $119 million, up to about $39 million. The county can raise the money by either imposing a quarter-cent sales tax, similar to the transit tax in the seven-county metro or the five-county metro area, or it can impose a wheelage tax, again, similar to what's allowed in the metro area, up to $10 per vehicle. Revenues are dedicated first to the county's portion of DMC, and any revenues raised in addition or above that amount may be spent by the county for any other transportation project within the county.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, the only differences are the terminology that the Senate uses in calling it a transportation tax and the expiration date of December 31, 2046, as opposed to 2041 in the House provision.
Oh. Further? Mr. Michael?
Chair, members of the committee.
I apologize. Representative Norton?
Just for clarification, on the county tax authority, do you also have the wheelage tax in your bill? I had understood you didn't tonight. You
do. Ms. Pollack?
In the Senate. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Michael? Or did you? Ms. Pollack?
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, yes. I was just looking for the reference in the side.
Okay.
Super.
It's not Where dedicated to DMC.
Oh, and it's not dedicated to DMC?
No.
Okay. Where is that? Is that on? No, that's not it.
It's 79. Not on the side by side, but it's in the language.
Okay.
Madam Chair, it's not in the side by side, but it is in the Senate.
Okay.
And Madam Chair.
Ms. Senator Skoy.
Just real briefly, maybe Mr. Michaels or Section 7, where you're talking about after the county is reached its ability to fund the transportation projects in the DMC, it can use the money for other transportation projects. But then on the final line there, it says that these taxes expire when they have revenue sufficient to meet its obligations to the DMC transit projects. Is that a conflict, or am I not understanding that?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I don't think it's a conflict. Basically, there's a limit on how much annually can go to the DMC, but once they have met their total obligation to the DMC from those annual contributions, then the tax expires.
So an annual limit.
Right, and the annual limit is set at a local match, similar to what the state aid match is. So their match is actually a rate of it's either 40% of the state transit aid paid that year or 0.15, whichever is less.
I get it.
So if there isn't a lot of state transit aid going in to the DMC project in that year, then the county is allowed to hold on to the revenues and use it for county projects.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so.
But they still would be required to terminate when that date's reached.
Thank you.
Section 8 of the House bill on page 78 of the side-by-side is the provision that provides the state infrastructure and transit aid, which is the basic funding for this project. The definitions, the key definition is what qualified expenditures are, and these are essentially capital outlays by the Mayo Clinic for building construction projects in the city of Rochester, and that's what people generally refer to as both the hard and soft costs of these projects. So it includes the architectural and design and engineering and all of that work, as well as the bricks and mortar and the labor costs. And when those expenditures exceed $200 million after July 1st of this year, then those expenditures are qualified expenditures that will start generating entitlements to state aid under this section. What the Mayo Clinic will be required to certify these amounts annually to deed to determine, and then deed will determine the entitlement to aid. And basically, this aid is broken into two components. There's a state general infrastructure aid that can go for any of these kinds of projects with the exception of transit-related projects. And that aid is calculated by just taking the qualified expenditures. So that's the amount of the Mayo Clinic's construction project expenditures over a threshold of $200 million times 2.75%. So everything over $200 million generates aid. Now, in any, there's an annual cap on this aid that it can't exceed $30 million in any year. If the entitlement would exceed that, then it becomes a carryover and can carry over to the next year and so forth. And the total amount of state aid under this sort of general category that can be used for anything other than transit is $327 million. Now, in order to qualify for that, the city is required to put up $128 million, using, again, its tax sources that we described earlier, or they could use any other money that the city has available aside from these special taxes. But I think the presumption is that they will use these special taxes to match that. And the bill does not specify when those local contributions will be required, but instead it requires that the city and deed reach an agreement on when those local contributions will be made over the life of the project, and that was done to give the city flexibility as to how it raises this revenue and therefore matches the state aid. So that's the rule on the general on the general purpose aid. Then there's a second category of aid that called transit aid that's designed to help pay for the transit components of the project, which, as the plan calls for, is a substantial part of the project. And that aid is calculated in exactly the same way, except that the state aid computation is 0.75 rather than 2.75. So when you sum the two together, you get 3.5%, which matches what the Senate has excuse me, ignore that. the maximum amount of transit aid is capped each year at $7.5 million. There's a local match, which Ms. Dalton just described before, which is the lesser of either 40% of what the state aid is or the amount that the county could raise by imposing a 0.15 general sales tax in the county. Now, the county does not have to impose that tax to meet the local match. It could come up with other funds or could agree with the city to come up with other funds to do this. So this is not de facto compels the county to impose this tax to get it. It just simply that's the measure of the amount of local match that has to be provided. The aid terminates in fiscal year 2041. Now, if the maximums are reached under the 327 for the general aid or the 116 for the transit aid, that it will terminate earlier than that. And I think most of the projections show that it would terminate earlier than that, that it's front-loaded. So that's the description. I'll let Ms. Pollock.
Madam Chair, could I just ask a question?
Senator Senjum, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, I think I know the answer. I just want to affirm it. In the area of qualified expenditures, and your bill notes $200 million within the medical district, if, for instance, a major hotel, it doesn't have to be major, but if someone else outside of Mayo put together, say, a private investment worth $25 million, would that count against the $200 million or are we just disregarding, at least in the bill, any aspect of other investments counting towards an investment to the medical, what we call the Medical Development District?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, the way the bill is drafted, its qualified expenditures are expenditures by the medical business entity, which is de facto the Mayo Clinic. So if you had, you know, the Hilton Corporation or Marriott come in and spend $50 million to build a hotel, that would not, as the bill is currently drafted.
Okay. I thought as well. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Pollack? Oh, Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Michaels, so on, I'm looking at the House language, line 182.22, requires the city to make a qualifying match. Hold up, sorry. 182.24, funds other than state aid received under this section. So could they get a state grant of some type and the city use that as their qualifying match?
They're getting one. $30 million a year.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, yes. If they get some other money that they're authority to use for some other, you know, under the terms of that, yes, they could. So they could use LGA for this, for example.
And I still want to hear from MMB. Are you going to have to start taxes at 10?
We can delay it a little bit.
Well, okay. Well, we haven't heard the, we have a lot left to go here. So let's keep going. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and members, the difference in the state infrastructure aid in the Senate provision is that qualified expenditures have to reach $250 million, and then it's the increment over that where the state infrastructure aid would kick in. The state aid is contributed at 3%, I believe.
Yes.
And unlike the Senate provision, it does not have a maximum annual cap. The authority can use the aid only for the public infrastructure costs, not transit costs. And there's some language requiring prevailing wages to be paid on the public infrastructure projects. The local transit aid provisions are the same, except for the Senate does not allow the alternative of the 40% of state transit aid match, only the amount that would be raised had the county implemented a 0.15% general sales tax.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, sections 9 and 10 we've actually already discussed.
Right.
They are the actual changes to the Rochester local sales tax. There's also an additional thing related to the $5 million of local revenue sharing, but we won't talk about that as part of this right now. Section 11 is the termination of these taxing authorities. Again, they are similar, except we have them terminate on 2041, at the end of 2041, and the Senate has them terminate at 2046. And then Section 12 requires Rochester Area Impact Development Transportation Impact Study to look at running high-speed rail between Rochester and the Mall of America, the airport, and Union Depot. We understand there is an existing transportation study already going on in the county, and they have already agreed informally to include this in that transportation study. And the Senate does not have this provision.
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair, I have nothing more.
Okay, can we fit it in? I just want to ask the woman, Kristen, if she's still here. Oh, yes, welcome. If you could join us. And Senator Scoyne and I both just met you today, and I've had a lot of conversation from all kinds of people saying, you know, you can do these things and it doesn't count against state debt, or you can't do these things. And the way I look at the Senate provision right now is it seems like the Senate provision would count against state debt. But I think we need to get it on the record if that's not the case, because, Senator Scoy, I think you and I, in conversations we've had, both don't intend that this project will count against the state's capacity. So I think we just want to learn a little bit about really kind of what the facts are as it relates to that, and think about, you know, in the few days we have left, how we should come to, because it's obvious, you know, the conferees, we're going to do something. And this is going to happen, but we just have to get it right and protect the taxpayers. So welcome to the Tax Conference Committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm here to address the capital guidelines.
And Ms. Hansen, can you pull your mic even closer?
I can.
Okay, thank you so much.
In regards to the two pieces of legislation, the House bill does have the city issuing the bonds, and we have vetted this with public finance professionals, and we feel that since the city has granted other sources to be identified and allow for the geo-backing of the bonds, that that provision would not count against the state's investment guidelines. In regards to the Senate proposal, it currently has the authority issuing the debt, and we feel that these would count against the guidelines. There is language in the bill as currently drafted that talks about the infrastructure aid is one of the only sources sufficient to pay the debt service. It's that language is sufficient to.
Could she identify
maybe staff can help us. What, Ms. Hansen, Ms. McQuay, do you know?
Madam Chair and members, the lines that Ms. Hansen is referring to begin on page 234 of the Senate document.
Okay, 234 of the Senate bill.
And on line 3.
Line 3. Ms. Hansen.
Thank you. In reviewing this language, it talks about the infrastructure aid as well as possible additional sources to be sufficient enough to make the to pay for the projects, which we understand will be paid for by bond issues. And this language is troubling, and we feel that because of the way it's worded, it would count against the guidelines. The authority currently does not have the same flexibility in revenue sources that cities currently have. And so in order to prevent this from counting against the guidelines, there would need to be legislative or language change in that regards.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Chair Skoy.
Thank you. And the question I have is I thought we had revenue streams to back the bonds that were city, county, and mail, and that this would go into the HRA or the Port Authority type governmental entity. And then we also are on 231.14. Not a debt of city, county, or state, nor a pledge of the full faith credit of the city, county, or state. And that language is not sufficient.
Ms. Hansen.
Chair, Senator Skoy, even though the language is worded as such, because the language talks about that the authority could issue those bonds with that revenue stream being a larger percentage or even the full amount to pay the debt service, it would count against the guidelines.
Okay, Senator Rest.
Chair, in the House provision, page 182, lines 15 through 19, how is that different?
Ms. Hansen, page 182 of the House, do you have that with you?
Senator Rest, this differs. The House language is different because the city has granted other sources to be identified and allows for the geo-backing of the bonds.
So,
Senator Rest.
So the the language that says that is sufficient is not troubling.
Not in that particular piece of legislation. Senator Rest, not in this particular piece of legislation because of the multiple revenue sources that are available to the city to make debt payments.
Why are the revenue, the multiple revenue sources for the HRA not adequate when they are for the city?
Ms. Hansen.
Senator Skoy, under the way that the legislation is currently drafted, it has the infrastructure and transit aid going to the authority, but it doesn't have the same types. The authority does not have the same revenue sources that cities have.
I think she's misreading. We'll have to find the language.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, we'll get some language. I think there might be misreading that because our intent is for the HRA to have revenue streams comparable to the city, and that the city has responsibility to the county and mail. And we think that that's very comparable.
Well, Ms. Hansen, if you want to comment on that, I think one of the core principles in the House conferees view on this, and I asked Representative Norton to talk about it, is you know, we really want the city in charge. This is public money. This is a massive amount of public money. And why do we want the city in charge? They're elected. And if the folks down there don't like what's going on, they'll have some say-so. And so we really, the House conferees, you know, had a lot of difficulty, and indeed members of the House, I think, even supporting this kind of a proposal for Mayo. But to have, you know, a lot of public money, and we know that means strings are attached, and we want the locally elected body. We haven't seen in the state when, you know, when we do similar things, we don't ask a separate authority. We ask, you know, for example, in my city, I'll just use my city as an example, we have a port authority, but everything goes through the city council in the sense that they have to affirm the act of the port authority. And they have to stand for election on that. So we don't let some super authority that's got statewide appointees sort of running the city for the Mall of America. You know, we think the local unit of government is competent and can handle it. And I think there's an implicit, in my mind, if it takes a state authority with statewide appointed members, it's sort of implying really it is a state-backed instrument of debt. So, we have concerns, and I just want to get it on the record that the House conferees feel that way. And if Representative Norton, if I could ask her to jump in. Sure, and I think, you know, she'd like to tell you more where we're coming from here. So,
I think that the city does have a lot of authority. I mean, they have the authority to approve the development plans. They have the final say on the land use plans, so there's a lot of control given to the city. I just think that with the amount of private dollars that's going to have to flow into this for this to succeed, that it's going to have to be a broader view than just the city of Rochester. I don't think that they'll have the capabilities to bring that private money to bear as the medical facility in that community will. And that's my concern on this, is that we have to make sure that those other private funds flow into this, because otherwise it isn't going to work.
Well, in Senator Scott, I'll just say I don't see that as different, whether it's a city or a kind of a super authority with more of a state focus, that the private money has to be there. So in a city-run similar kind of project, again, let's use my city, the private investment is still taking place, and the city has, in, I would argue, even more flexibility to work to bring more private investment to bear in a much more multi-layered kind of plan development. But I know Representative Norton has thoughts on this, and I'm sure Senator Senjum does too, and maybe we can have them just get a few words in before you have to run taxes, because I know we'll continue talking about this, but I think people want to hear the local legislators' thoughts on this. So Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would agree that we do need to look at how to protect private investment and encourage it, and we don't want to do anything that would halt that process, because it is going to be vital. On the other hand, Representative Lincheski had an opportunity to come to our community for several hundred people in a room to discuss the DMC. So she saw firsthand what I see and what I know Senator Senjum sees, which is concern in our community that decisions get made too far away from our community and without. Transparency is part of it, but I think a trust in our local elected officials who answer to the citizens so that the decisions are made closer to home. So Representative Lincheski heard that firsthand because she sat there. Senator Senjum and I hear it regularly from our constituents. And so for us, we're trying to balance what's good for our community and what the constituents, and the more they learn, the more they're sharing with us. They do want good transparency and accountability by elected officials, but still respect the Mayo Clinic's concerns and others' concerns about that private investment and not discouraging it. So I think we have some work to do personally in that area. And I will say the House has been apparently very different on the floor and in committees. Their approach is much more cautious than the Senate's has been on this issue. So we also have our House members to contend with when we go back with the bill. So I will just leave it at that.
Well spoken. Senator Senjum, thoughts on where we're at right now?
Again, maybe to this particular point, and I would say and believe that the city has a lot of authority. In my mind, they could kill or move a project almost at will. The proposals say that every project has to meet city council ordinances. Those ordinances call for public hearings, notice of the public, and a process that has to take place before the authority can even act. So from the standpoint of the city's interests being protected, I think that they are, not unlike they are today on any development which occurs in Rochester. And then looking at just making this, I'll call it magic work, I will just be kind of frank. Mayo Clinic can go to most offices in this world and receive attention and perhaps some level of interest. I think we compromise the project if we expect the city to take that implementing feature, because cities have their own business to undertake, and that's planning, zoning, public safety, public works, all the things that cities do. My hope is, at least from the standpoint of implementation, and I'm talking about the implementation of the magic, this great big development, can occur largely within the framework of a Mayo-driven private nonprofit organization, and the oversight is all there in my mind for the city council to react to that private corporation's ideas, and then ultimately the authority acts not only on the ideas, the city council's input, but finally on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who have hundreds of millions of dollars into this as well. And so I see it kind of as this three-legged stool. I don't think we can forget the state of Minnesota's public interest in this project, and that's why, for instance, I've advocated for at least half of the members to be representative, if you will, of the state of Minnesota. So maybe some differences.
Okay, Representative Dabney. You want to use your mic?
My apologies. I guess I'm going to reinforce the House position on the city having authority over the development inside of its own city. I think that's important. I think it's not just a matter of the city reviewing the plans, but the city approving the plans. Not just that the plans be in line with the city's comprehensive plan, but that they be part of the city's comprehensive plan, that the city have the authority over what's going on inside the city. And unfortunately, the Senate language doesn't allow for the city to have that authority. It doesn't allow for that sort of tight coordination between the transit and the public utilities and the public roads and the Mayo Clinic's developments that I think is necessary both for the transparency and accountability for the residents, but also for efficiency and the like in terms of how the plans are implemented. I think we all want this to be successful. There's no question about that. What we want, though, is an equal partnership between the city and the DMC folks, where the city and its citizens get to weigh in, and not just weigh in, but you know, have the final say in what is going on in their city.
Okay. Chair Scoy, do you want to recess? And I know we're definitely coming back tonight, but if we can work it in the middle of the day, we're going to try to do that too, right?
Absolutely. Let's try to get back together this afternoon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're in recess.
Thank you.